Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Diane Lauderdale, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Health Studies at the University of Chicago, was one of the people involved in a recently reported study.
We undertook a study to measure sleep in a cohort of community-dwelling persons that had been followed for 15 years for the development of coronary artery risk factors and disease. And we added an objective sleep measurement for about 700 members of the cohort.
And why did you seek to look at sleep?
There have been a number of recent studies that were done in sleep laboratories where sleep was manipulated and people who were not allowed to sleep for very many hours had short-term effects that were surprising and large. For example, their glucose metabolism was worse after a few nights of only being allowed to sleep 4 hours a night, so it looked like they might be on the road to getting diabetes. And hormones that regulated hunger, leptin and ghrelin, their daily 24-hour cycle was altered in a way that made people feel hungrier than they would otherwise. And then other studies have found cognitive effects, that people couldn't learn things and remember things that they had heard the day before if they hadn't slept well. And then on the other hand, there'd been some big studies where information had been collected from people about how long they usually slept, just by asking them, how much sleep do you usually get at night? And associations were found between those self-reported sleep hours and risk of mortality, risk of being obese.
And that's quite important, that sort of finding, because when you talk to sleep specialists, they say there's a lot of difference between common or garden insomnia and the artificial laboratory situation where you don't allow people to sleep, because people who are insomniac often perform quite well, and they don't get into a lot of strife. So it's important to see whether or not what happens in the lab happens in real life.
Right. There were two reasons to undertake a different kind of study. One was that maybe the people who are sleep restricted in the laboratory, there's no knowing whether that would actually play out over time, or whether the situation that if people can keep themselves from sleeping as long, either because they don't want to take the time to sleep, or because they just can't get the sleep, whether it has the same results as being systematically awakened when you're deep asleep in the laboratory. So there was that. And then on the other hand, these studies that had found the associations between self-reported sleep hours and serious health outcomes, there are questions about whether people actually have a very good grasp of how much they sleep. And so it may be when you ask somebody, how much do you usually sleep, the information you're getting says something about how much they sleep, but it says also something about how they feel about their sleep and how they feel about whether they're able to realize the schedule they want, accomplish what they want. There might be some extra information that's influencing how they answer it, so it might not be completely accurate. So we wanted to do a study where we measured sleep without disrupting it.
So what did you do?
We gave people a little wrist device called an actigraph, which is like a very sensitive pedometer that measures movement in all directions, and it gives a very good estimate of when they were actually asleep.
What were you looking for?
Our original interest was actually in looking at whether measured sleep influenced people's change in their weight. And many studies have found that if you measure sleep or ask people about sleep and measure their weight at the same time, there is a correlation that people who weigh more sleep less. And so the hypothesis, though, had come about that maybe people sleeping less and less was actually one of the factors driving the obesity epidemic. In this case, it's completely reasonable to think that the causal direction could be either which way, though. And so
if you're overweight, you could be snoring and having sleep apnea or something like that.
Or just generally not able to sleep as well.
So what did you find?
For that piece, for the body mass index, we found that we did have a cross-sectional association. So the measured sleep and BMI at the same time were correlated, but that there was absolutely no effect of sleep duration on change in BMI over 5 years.
That means fat people didn't sleep as well, but looking at the cause and effect the other way around, if it was cause and effect, there was no evidence from this study that sleeping badly makes you more likely to put on weight. As Diane Lauderdale said earlier, this long-term follow-up study was really into heart disease. So they chose something called coronary artery calcification found on a CT scan as a marker for arterial damage, and then compared the amount of artery calcium to sleep patterns.
We had two CT scans where the calcification was measured 5 years apart, and then between those we measured sleep twice. And we took the people who did not have any evidence of calcification at the baseline CT exam, and then we looked at whether their average measured sleep predicted their having first evidence of calcification 5 years later. And there was an association, and we were very surprised at how strong it was. I should say, first of all, that the actual measured sleep duration in our cohort was less than maybe what people expect. So it was an urban population in their 40s, and the average was only 6 hours, although people generally thought they were getting closer to 7 hours of sleep. A significant number were sleeping less than 5 hours, and only a handful, like, you know, six people actually measured at 8 hours or more of sleep a night. So we don't know whether this is an unusual population or this is actually how 40-year-olds all over the U.S. sleep, and we don't know whether it's how people have always slept or whether this indeed is less than people used to sleep, but in any event, it was surprising. So what we found is that the people who slept less than 5 hours a night, about 27% of them developed calcification over the course of 5 years. The people who were in the middle, who slept 5 to 7 hours, about 11% developed calcification, and the people who were sleeping 7 hours or more, only 6% developed calcification. And then through statistical methods, we tried to make sure that we weren't seeing that association just because of correlations with other factors.
Such as smoking, overweight, things like that.
Yes. We took into account all those things, and there was still a very strong association between the measured sleep duration and the calcification.
But of course, associations don't tell you whether sleep's just a marker for something else and has nothing whatsoever to do with coronary calcification.
You're quite right. It could be some other factor because we understand so little about what influences how much people sleep. And clearly there are social conditions, economic conditions, household conditions, as well as psychological ones and health ones. We just have started to investigate this. So there could be some factor or factors that influence how much people sleep that also influence separately the risk of coronary artery disease.
And were their coronary risk factors higher as well in relation to their sleep, so their cholesterol level, their blood pressure, and so on?
Some of them were and some were not. Blood pressure was related to sleep. Fewer of the cardiovascular factors than we might expect were related to sleep.
And what predicted whether or not you were a person who slept 7 hours versus under five?
Women slept longer than men, and that's been found in lots of studies. Women just seem to need more sleep than men. We only had about a 12-year age span, and so age wasn't related, although if you have a bigger age range, you do find an association. People with more education and with higher income did not devote more time to trying to sleep, but they were more successful at sleeping during that time. So they ended up getting more sleep than people with less education and lower income. People who smoked got less sleep, which is consistent with nicotine being a stimulant. People who drank more alcohol spent more time in bed but did not get more sleep. Physical activity was not related.
But since the study did not prove cause and effect, it can't be assumed that getting more sleep is good for your arteries. Well, at least that's my excuse for not getting more kip. Associate Professor Diane Lauderdale is in the Department of Health Studies at the University of Chicago.
Now for a break between two interviews. Another take on sleeplessness. Katie Webster. Hoo-wee, sweet daddy.
High blood pressure, the jargon name for it is hypertension, is the single most important biological risk factor for premature death in Australia. It can start early in life and eventually may cause heart attacks, strokes and heart failure, meaning the heart muscle is knackered and can't pump blood around the body. So keeping your blood pressure down and lowering it if it's raised is important for a longer, healthier life. Things like exercise, weight loss and reducing alcohol intake all work, but in some people they aren't enough, so medications are needed. But there are people who, despite swallowing everything modern medicine has to offer, still have dangerously high blood pressure. It's called refractory. But there may be good news. A group at Monash Medical School in Melbourne, led by Professor Henry Crum, have piloted a surgical technique performed through a catheter threaded up from the thigh, which cuts or damages nerves linked to blood pressure control. They're called sympathetic nerves, and attacking them surgically isn't a new idea.
That is correct. In the 40s and 50s, there was a movement to surgically denervate, which was really quite major surgery, which did actually lower blood pressure, but it left patients with major problems. They couldn't stand up without fainting. They had impotence, other problems. So really, it's been a target for years, but this new approach is one that has, as we showed, major effects on blood pressure, but without major adverse effects.
When you say denervation, you're talking about cutting nerves. Just give us a bit of the background to what's going on in the body here that gives a rationale for the old surgery and indeed this new surgery.
Sure. Well, the target is the renal sympathetic nerves. These are nerves controlled by the brain, but running in the kidney, adjacent, in fact, to the main renal artery, and that's really the anatomical relationship that's being exploited by this new approach.
So this is the artery that provides oxygenated blood to the kidneys?
Correct. And it's also, importantly, accessible through the access to the femoral artery to reach that location to then apply the catheter.
And the femoral artery being the artery at the front of your thigh?
Correct. It's the artery which is normally used for routine cardiac and kidney procedures in the cath lab every day.
And it may be a surprise to some people to hear that the kidney is important for controlling your blood pressure.
The kidney, in fact, is a major source of hormones that are released to cause blood pressure increases, and importantly, it's a central control system for the so-called sympathetic or autonomic nervous system that is involved in the generation of high blood pressure.
If somebody's got common or garden high blood pressure, and we'll come back to your study in a moment, is it the kidney that's going wrong?
That's a very important question. The kidney may be part of the original problem, but it's certainly part of the ongoing problem once that hypertension is established. The kidney is involved in, as I've said, hormone release and getting rid of salt and water, and it is these problems that contribute to the blood pressure. We can't say with certainty that all causes of garden variety hypertension come from the kidney originally, but it's certainly intimately related to its progression and persistence.
Now, I in my ignorance thought that those early operations in the 40s and 50s to cut the sympathetic nerves were to actually relax the blood vessels, stop the tension on the blood vessels, and therefore lower blood pressure that way, which is what you were describing. People couldn't stand up without fainting. I wasn't aware that the nerves going to the kidney had much influence on how these hormones, particularly the hormones that control salt, made a difference to that.
I think that is possibly the most exciting aspect of this, that there are local effects of disrupting these nerves, release of the hormones, getting rid of salt and water, effects on the tone in the vessels in the kidney, but there is also evidence that these nerves feed back to the brain controlling the release of traffic down the nerves. So, in fact, the whole body is potentially affected. And personally, I think that is why we're seeing the dramatic results that we showed in this proof of concept study.
Tell us about the people that you operated on.
These were patients who had so-called refractory hypertension, and that means they're on three or more agents to treat their blood pressure, one of which is a diuretic or agent that gets rid of salt and water. Despite that, had elevations of blood pressure which were really quite dramatic, over 160 millimetres of mercury systolic.
That's the top figure. So despite maximal therapy, they were doing badly.
They were the worst of the worst hypertension patients, with obviously the greatest risk of downstream consequences such as stroke and heart attack, and that's really what we're trying to prevent here.
And this wasn't a control trial, this was a proof of principle.
All patients got the procedure. That was done for safety reasons and also to look for the effect first before we moved on to more controlled trials.
So what is the procedure?
The procedure involves cannulating the femoral artery, which is easily accessible in the groin, feeding a tube up into this main renal artery, which is adjacent to the nerves that run alongside of it, and applying what's called radio frequency signals, which again are commonly used in the treatment of various diseases in the heart, very low energy.
It generates heat.
It generates heat, and it generates it in a very localized area so that one can precisely pinpoint where one is actually directing that energy.
And it's through the artery wall you're doing it?
It's through the artery wall, and this heat energy will damage those nerves and, importantly, not cause damage to the lining of the renal artery, which obviously could cause downstream problems, in particular late narrowings, which is something we've looked very hard for.
And how do you know that the nerves are actually there? Because anatomy is variable between individuals, so sometimes it might go above, sometimes it might go below. How do you know where the nerves actually are if you're not actually looking at them?
Well, that's a very good question as well, and the short answer is we don't know exactly where the nerves are in each individual patient, but the technique takes into account the fact that the nerves are running somewhere along the artery, and the application of this energy is on a rotational basis. If you think of the artery walls as a clock face, 5 to 6 energies are applied at various points along the clock face on pulling back of the catheter, so that we're pretty confident that there will be disruption of the nerves at some, if not all, of those energy applications.
And how often have you got to do this?
Both kidneys are denervated in the one sitting. There is evidence the nerves grow back. We know that from transplant studies. But we also know that they're not necessarily the nerves that actually regenerate the elevated blood pressures.
And so what were the results?
Well, the results were quite striking. What we found was a very marked reduction in blood pressure overall. We saw it early. We saw it persist, and if anything, it actually increased as patients went out to the 12 months, which is when the study ended.
Did it normalise?
Remember that these patients, their mean blood pressure was around 170, so it's a big ask to get patients to drop 40 millimetres of mercury to get to levels of, say, 130, but it dropped 27 millimetres of mercury overall. So that was a very dramatic result in these patients who, you'll recall, are very refractory by definition to standard agents.
And what about problems with low blood pressure, fainting when they stand up, perhaps even erectile dysfunction because of the sympathetic nerve problem?
We saw very few true symptomatic hypotension problems. We had 3 patients who we had to reduce their blood pressure medications because their blood pressures were getting on the low side. So we actually saw that as a good result. We've seen nothing in the way of impotence, those problems that plagued those early surgery studies. Some patients actually increased their medications, but very few of those were because they didn't respond, although it must be said we did have about 4 of the 45 patients who could be considered non-responders, so it didn't work in everyone.
And were there any effects on the stress hormones?
Yeah, importantly, we looked at a marker of sympathetic activity. In other words, were we achieving what we set out to do, which was to disrupt the nerves? And these nerves produce this hormone, noradrenaline, and using a technique pioneered by Murray Esler of the Baker, we were able to look specifically at that release within the kidney and found, in fact, a dramatic 45% reduction in release of that hormone. So to us, that was proof of concept that we actually were achieving denervation.
And complications like bleeding or disrupting the blood vessel?
We had one complication in a patient where there was damage to the arterial wall in introducing the catheter, but not actually with the radio frequency ablation itself. From patients who did get ablated, there were absolutely no consequences, no narrowings of the arteries, no thrombus formation, nothing.
How expensive is this procedure?
I have no idea what the cost.
Spoken like a true
be.
Researcher, Professor Kahn.
I'm sure, and I should say that this is a commercial exercise. We were reached out to by an American startup biotechnology company who are seeing this as a commercial venture, but I have no idea what the eventual cost may be.
Next step is a proper randomised trial in a larger number of people. Henry Crum is Professor of Medicine and Director of the Centre for Cardiovascular Research and Education in Therapeutics at Monash University in Melbourne.
Once again, we're indebted to Dr. Norman Swan of the Health Report on Australian Broadcasting Corporation's podcast site, where you can download these podcasts and listen to them too. We'll take a break at the halfway mark in the show. Coming up, Katie Webster, Hard Lovin' Mama. Thank you.
say you better be in good shape when you come my way. Cause I'm a heart of a mama, healthy, firm and fine. And if you fool around with me, I know I can make you mine all the time. Now you may be a playboy, handsome and free, but there'll be no more playing with you playing around with me. Cause I'm a heart-loving mama, healthy, firm and fine. And if you fool around with me, I know I can make you mine all the time. Baby, I don't take nothing, cause I know what I got is.
It's time for Disrespect's Review of the News. As we mentioned most weeks, these are not the whole stories. These are the stories taken from the articles that in the papers that we mention and the writers that we name on the broadcast. Critics rail at TTC hike. The Toronto Sun, Monday, November 9th. Fare increase will create hardship by Sharon Lim, Sun Media. Marsha can't afford to pay the proposed TTC fare hikes, which are slated to take effect in the new year. The 63-year-old former Toronto secretary is an Ontario Disability Support Program recipient who uses a TTC MetroPass to get around the city. I think it's disgraceful when people are losing their jobs that TTC fares are going up, Marsha said recently while lining up for groceries at the Scott Missions Food Bank. Marsha pays $21 for her MetroPass, while ODSP picks up the remainder of the cost of the monthly pass. The increase is going to create a lot of hardship for a lot of people, and it could impact my lifestyle seriously, as I won't be able to get around as much, Marsha said. TTC commissioners are poised to vote on November 17th on hikes that would in January raise the adult cash fare for a single trip by 25 cents,
from $2.75 to $3. Metro passes would jump from $1.09 to $1.26. I'm sorry, from $109 to $126. And tokens sold in packages of 5 or 10 would increase from $2.25 to $2.50 each. David Smith, executive director of the Scott Mission, said the fare hikes will cause a loss in ridership. With rising rents, our clients on social assistance have to pay. Then the next thing is food, and then the TTC. So there's just nothing left to pay the fare increases for the TTC, Smith said. This fare hike will impact not just the poor, but the middle class as well, said Toronto councillor Michael Thompson. The bottom line for the TTC is we need to examine all the elements to look at inefficiencies in the system. TTC fares are among the highest charged for subway systems in Canada and the United States. Converted into Canadian currency, here are some examples of what a single cash fare costs in other cities. Montreal, $2.75. New York, $2.25. Paris, $2.52. Boston, $2.15. And Los Angeles, $1.34. And from the Globe and Mail, Hidden Jobless Cloud Economic Picture by Tavia Grant. In a country that dutifully tallies everything from egg sales to steel wire production, one crucial piece of the economic puzzle is missing. When Statistics Canada releases its monthly report on employment insurance, notable will be the lack of information on the number of unemployed who have exhausted their EI benefits. This is frustrating the efforts of economists and also complicating public policy, because how can governments and support agencies respond if the full extent of the problem is unknown? We don't know whether people are departing for new employment or if they are exhausting benefits and persisting in the unemployment pool. And that is problematic, said Grant Bishop, an economist at Toronto Dominion Bank. There should definitely be better disclosure. Analysts say without this data, the problems are multiple. For one, EI statistics will become less meaningful because they won't reflect the growing number of people who are running out of benefits. The longer-term concern is that if these people can't find work, a growing number will strip their assets in order to qualify for welfare. Without statistics on benefits being exhausted, it's difficult to gauge how many people may be headed towards welfare. The federal government used to regularly publish national welfare rates until 1996, when it stopped requiring the provinces to submit data. Now only four provinces publish monthly data on their websites, and many of the numbers aren't comparable because they're tallied differently, says Gilles Séguin, who worked on welfare program information for the federal government from 1975 to 2003. There's no public national source that tells us how many people are on welfare right now. Caseloads are climbing, however, as hiring remains sluggish. In Ontario, the number of welfare cases reached 238,598 in August, the highest since March 2000. Human Resources and Skills Development Canada, the department that oversees EI, was unable to say how many people have exhausted their benefits this year. Its most recent report is based on 2006 and 2007 data. From the Hamilton Spectator, Tom Baker, prosperity is not around the corner. More than 4 million people in Canada are living on low incomes. The jobless recovery is not working. Certainly Hamilton offers little evidence of an economic rebound, according to Steve Arnold's October 10th report in the Hamilton Spectator. The only local growth over the last year was 67% increase in job losses. This economic crash has been particularly steep compared to Canada's other recent brushes with economic disaster. The 1981-82 recession lasted 18 months, with the real gross domestic product falling 6.7%. The 1990-91 recession lasted 12 months, and the GDP fell 3.2%. In the first 9 months of the current recession, GDP plunged 3.3% adjusted for inflation. The latest downward economic spiral is an even more gut-wrenching 7.4% drop in total production using today's prices. Profit levels took only 18 months to recover after the 1980s crash. However, profit levels did not climb back out of the 1990s recession for 4 years. This time, profit losses in the recession already total four times the amount lost in the 1990s crash. The economic slowdown has slashed profits 40% since the recession started last year. Wages took a larger share of national income, but only in the context of this shrinking economic pie. Greater tensions over a smaller GDP reflect growing frustration with a lack of jobs and income. Prosperity is not around the corner. After the 1980s crash, it took 8 years for official unemployment to fall back to pre-recession levels of 7.5%. It took 9 years after the 1990 crash. In both cases, official unemployment peaked at over 12% before its slow gradual decline. As of September, the official unemployment rate had climbed to 8.4%. The Hamilton jobless rate reached 9.1%, or 36,300 people, last month. Currently, there are 16,000 regular employment insurance claims active in Hamilton. That means more than half the unemployed in Hamilton are not getting EI benefits. The Canadian Labour Congress notes EI coverage now includes only 47% of the unemployed. Even Toronto Dominion Bank economists agree that too many unemployed people are shut out from the current EI system. Failure to restore EI coverage is courting disaster by forcing each community to fend for themselves. We need bold action now to abolish the vicious snare of variable entrance requirements that hobble the EI system. The alternative is a continuing crisis that Canada and our city cannot survive. This from the Globe and Mail, Saturday, November 7th. Children are worried sick over H1N1 spread. By Ingrid Peritz in Montreal. With the swine flu taking its toll on an anxious nation's psyche, children are proving to be an at-risk group in more ways than one. Parents and health professionals hear it from children confronting the new realities of absent classmates, cancelled hockey games, and daily doses of H1N1 warnings. Ontario psychologist Marianne Boer was talking to an 8-year-old recently who was upset about a classmate stricken with the flu. "All the kids think he's going to die," the third grader told her. The spread of H1N1 has touched communities across Canada and exposed a generation of kids to a seemingly amorphous new threat. In the 1950s, school children had to do duck and cover drills in the case of a nuclear weapons attack. Now parents and public officials teach kids to shield themselves from danger with orders to cough and cover, or at least to sneeze into their elbows. The new health regime of do's and don'ts can be confusing. One 13-year-old in Montreal was yelled at by his teacher this week because he coughed in class and said he didn't feel well. "Why didn't you stay home?" she demanded. The Canadian Psychological Association warns that the threat of illness can be especially upsetting to children and teenagers, and endless reports of vaccine queues, death tallies, and worried parents have become hard to escape. "If kids are exposed to it all the time, it's going to make them more anxious," said Dr. Boer, chief psychologist for the York Region District School Board. "Sometimes you've got to tune it out." The best solution, psychologists say, is cues from mom and dad. "I would caution parents to be calm. If they're over-anxious, children will pick up on that, and they too will become over-anxious," said Douglas Agar, president of the British Columbia Association of School Psychologists. "Kids may not understand all the working of the flu virus," he said, "but they do understand that mummy is a little nervous." And now a break with Katie Webster again. Two-Fisted Mama. and Jim Coyle from the Star via the Spec. SARS should have left us ready for H1N1. On dusty bookshelves in many offices at Queen's Park, you'll find them. Multi-volume reports on Walkerton, on Iberwash, on forensic pathology, on wrongful convictions, and more. They're the work of judicial inquiries, ordered in the white heat of crisis, usually years and millions of dollars in the making, released in a media spotlight, then consigned, as often as not, to the obscurity of half measures and good intentions. The late Archie Campbell understood that it's probably human nature to divert the gaze from other matters once any emergency is passed. But he hoped and expected that in matters of pandemics and public health, things might unfold otherwise. Campbell was the judge who led the inquiry into the SARS outbreak in 2003. He died in 2007 at 65, too ill to have attended the release earlier that year of his final report. But what a clarion call it seems in hindsight against just the kind of lost focus and lost momentum that appears to have contributed to the H1N1 immunization fiasco. Said Campbell, SARS may be the last wake-up call we get before the next major outbreak of infection, whether it turns out to be an influenza pandemic or some other health crisis. This is why we cannot forget how bad SARS was. But Campbell knew better. He knew mere recommendations couldn't make the province a better and safer place. He knew only commitment and action could, and he knew that required political will. The most difficult of forces to sustain in a business of infinite demand and finite capacity. That's why Campbell's first interim report in April 2004 ended with such an emphasis, not on matters technical, but on political will. The decline of public health protection in Ontario reflects a consistent lack of political will over the regime of many successive governments and all three political parties. It will require significant and political will on the part of the Minister of Health in the Ontario government to commit the funds and the long-term resolve that are required to bring our public health protection against infectious diseases up to a reasonable standard. It would be very easy, now that the SARS outbreak is over, to put public health reform on the back burner. It is a general habit of governments to respond to a crisis by making a few improvements without fixing the underlying problems responsible for the crisis. It would be a tragedy if that turned out to be the case with SARS. There is no longer any excuse for governments and hospitals to be caught off guard. When Dalton McGuinty says, one of the things we need to do when all this is over is to bring the feds together with the provinces and territories and ask ourselves questions about how we manage this, he acknowledges a breaking of faith with the Archie Campbells, with the Sheila Bazreurs, with those who died of SARS, with all the lessons they taught that weren't adequately learned. Vaccine shortage closes Halton clinics, from The Spectator by Dana Brown. Halton Region has closed its H1N1 clinics because of a vaccine shortage, but Hamilton is confident its supply will carry the city through. Dr. Nin Tran, Hamilton's Associate Medical Officer of Health, said how long the remaining vaccine lasts depends on the uptake early this week and how many providers are requesting it. Hamilton's expecting a new shipment of vaccine from the province by Wednesday. Halton said if the province receives vaccine, the region could get its allotment as early as tomorrow and reopen the clinics on Wednesday. We still have some left, and that at least for the next few days, we would still be able to fill family physician orders. But we really do have to wait for more vaccine from the province who get it from the feds, said Dr. Bob Nozell, Halton's Medical Officer of Health. Halton had immunized earlier in the week nearly 42,000 people. The region was given 73,000 H1N1 vaccine doses. Hamilton received 81,500 doses. Tran said he thinks there will be an announcement shortly about giving the shot to more people. I expect that sometime this week it will be opened up to additional groups, but probably not yet to the general public, he said. Halton will open a clinic for pregnant women who want the unadjuvanted vaccine. The site at the Halton Regional Center will offer the shot from 4 to 8 p.m. The region is advising people to check its website, halton.ca, for clinic updates. Residents can also call 311 for information. Again, The Spectator, Joanna Friknich, A Third Wave, Experts Debate Vaccine Timing. The specter of a third wave of H1N1 is being raised as Hamilton and Halton are at the peak of the pandemic. Whether this flu will come back for one more round between January and March is the big question infectious disease experts are hotly debating. We're in very early days yet, frankly, said Dr. David Higgins, chief of staff at St. Joseph's Healthcare. I remain very anxious because I think we haven't seen the impact yet of the virus on the more fragile and elderly people in the community. The timing of the epidemic is the young people first, the kids, then the parents, and then the middle-aged to older people as it spreads around the community. Those are the folks who often have more significant medical problems who would be at greater risk once they get the infection. Plus, most people haven't had H1N1 yet, despite widespread flu in the area, says Dr. Chris Mackey, Hamilton's Associate Medical Officer of Health. He notes tests show only about half of people with flu-like symptoms actually have H1N1. It's a high number, more than double what is seen in a typical flu season, but nowhere near the majority. Mackey says only those with a laboratory-confirmed case of H1N1 should skip the shot. I hope that people continue to come and get the vaccine, he said. We're probably at or near the peak right now, but there's two halves to a peak, and we still have half the wave to go through. It's also key to preventing a third wave in Hamilton. Assuming people keep coming to get the vaccine, then I don't think we'll have much of a third wave, if any, said Mackey. The chances of us getting one in Hamilton are pretty low. We've been hit very hard now, so we have a lot of immunity in the community. We've got a lot of vaccine out, and we're going to get a lot more vaccine out. If past pandemics are any indication, third waves tend to have much less impact in communities hardest hit during the second wave. The hope is that Hamilton and Halton will be protected from a third wave because they were among the earliest areas of the province reporting widespread H1N1, but with flu there's no guarantee. There's still a great deal of unknowns. Said Dr. Michael Gardam, Director of Infectious Disease Prevention and Control at Ontario's Agency for Health Protection and Promotion. You never know what this flu is going to do. And again from The Spectator, Friday, November 6th, Andrew Dreschel. Public health protects us from ourselves. When the Spec asked how many people had tested positive for H1N1, Hamilton Public Health refused to release the information. Why? The out-of-the-gate explanation from Dr. Chris Mackey, Associate Medical Officer of Health, was troubling to say the least. Because, Mackey told the reporter, public health doesn't want to generate any more fear than there already is, especially if there isn't enough vaccine to give to everybody. The overt paternalism in that statement gives shockingly short shrift to the public's basic right to know. It also harkens back to the dark days of 2006 when public health willfully sat on information about a Legionella outbreak. Mackey's comment followed a number of email exchanges with the reporter in which he first held out the prospect of providing the data if a shipment of vaccine arrived. When a supply came in later that day, the reporter again asked for the lab results. Mackey said he would send it when they had confirmation of a third shipment if he was authorized by Dr. Elizabeth Richardson, Hamilton's Medical Officer of Health. That never happened. The linking of the lab results to the supply of vaccine clearly suggests someone was feeling a patronizing need to protect the public from itself. Underscoring that point is the embarrassing fact that the Spec ultimately got the results from Dr. Bob Nozell, Halton's Regional Medical Officer of Health. The information shared by Halton showed positive H1N1 tests had doubled in a week. Guess what? It didn't scare people spitless or create a crisis of confidence. It was just one more piece of relevant information in a flood of flu stories. I asked Richardson, Mackey's boss, why your people refused to release test results. Richardson said there was no attempt to hide anything, that her department has been a model of transparency and communication throughout the H1N1 pandemic. But in this case, Richardson said they wanted to make sure the information about positivity rates was accurate because of misinformation that had appeared in a CBC story. There's no motivation by us whatsoever to look at issues of fear and that sort of thing, said Richardson. It's to get accurate information out there so people can understand what's going on. To be fair to Mackey, he did make reference to wanting to check the lab results, although he hardly elaborated on it. But either that nor Richardson's devowal negates his comment about tamping down fear or linking the release to whether or not there was an adequate supply of vaccine. Frankly, it's hard to know if this is a case of internal miscommunication, trying to control the message, or perhaps an indication the hard-won lessons from the Legionella fiasco still haven't been completely absorbed. I do know this. When I called to speak to Richardson, I was told by the department's communications officer she didn't know if Richardson would get back to me that day or not. Why not? It's late in the day for our office, she said. It was only 3 p.m. Richardson did call, as she normally does. But how can you not question their lines of communication in light of an attitude like that? And from the Globe, report on mental health in the Saturday, November 7th focus section, by Andre Picard. Stability is the key to managing mental illness, experts suggest. Andre Picard looks at a Montreal project that puts housing first, providing troubled homeless people a stable home of their own. Now, this is a full page on this subject, although Picard's article is not a full page long. Again, you'll have to go to the Saturday, November 7th Globe and Mail, perhaps at the library, the focus section, F2. For the full story. Ricardo Madalena has lived in many places over the past 4 decades, fleabag apartments, a psychiatric hospital, prison, rooming houses, and on the streets. 4 years ago, he finally found a home. The 58-year-old, who suffers from severe schizophrenia and has struggled with alcoholism since his teens, moved into an innovative housing project in downtown Montreal that is operated by Chambre Clerc, a nonprofit group in the city that offers housing to longtime homeless men and women with severe psychiatric disabilities. Since I've moved here, I've gone through a metamorphosis, Mr. Madalena says. While he's eloquent and charming, his conversation veers routinely into improbable tales of wartime heroism and worldwide fame, belied by the grizzle look, including a missing finger cut off in a knifing, and modest surroundings. We're not a shelter. We provide housing, says Isabelle Leduc, Chambre Clerc's executive director. Our philosophy is housing first. You can't be healthy if you don't have a roof over your head, and that's particularly true of our tenants. Stability is the key to managing their illness, and they can't be stable living on the streets. In its landmark 2006 report entitled Out of the Shadows, At Last, Transforming Mental Health, Mental Illness, and Addiction Services in Canada, the Senate Health Committee placed a tremendous emphasis on housing. The committee led by Senators Michael Kirby and Wilbert Keon noted that there are at least 140,000 people suffering from mental illness in Canada who lack adequate housing. This is in part a legacy of deinstitutionalization. The number of long-term psychiatric beds in Canada plummeted from a high of close to 60,000 in the 1950s to just over 6,000 today. But that in itself was not a problem, but mental illness did not miraculously disappear, and governments did not invest in community supports for sufferers, creating legions of homeless men and women who pendle on street corners and sleep on grates. Mr. Kirby, who is now chairman of the Mental Health Commission of Canada, said of the issue last year, "Very little is known about the most effective ways of providing services to people living with mental illness who are homeless. What they require is a complex basket of services, including supportive housing, access to primary health care, and a wide range of other supports." As a result, the Commission has made this a priority issue, investing $110 million in research. The money's being reinvested in 5 demonstration research projects in Vancouver, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, and Moncton, each of which will focus on a distinct subgroup of homeless people living with mental illness, such as those who also have substance abuse problems, Aboriginal Canadians, and non-English-speaking new immigrants. Mr. Madalena, meanwhile, is sober, takes his medication, lives independently, pays his rent $335 a month, and has found stability and comfort he never believed possible. He doesn't allow himself to dream of the house in the suburbs with a 2-car garage, but after so long on the street, he appreciates his modest home. "It's so wonderful to have my own bed, my own room. I've decided to stay here for a while." That's it for Disrespect and the news this week. Come back next week. We'll have more. In the meantime, We'll run it out musically with Katie Webster one last time, A Little Meat on the Side. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.